We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dale, Jason Croft, is at the controls. For a long time in human history, going back some way, people have thought about, written about, even tried to construct ideal communities. And perhaps for just as long, others have looked at that effort and said that that's really just impossible. It's not something that you can do. There is no perfect place. That still, though, didn't seem to stop people from thinking about it. Even today, there are people who are trying to make the perfect place. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking a little bit about this impulse and about the desire and look at some places where people have tried to make the perfect place, according to them. And our guest for the show is J.C. Holman, and he has authored a book that explores this territory. The title of his book is In Utopia, Six Kinds of Eden and the Search for a Better Paradise. It's published by St. Martin's Press and is just recently out. Our guest, J.C. Holman, is the author of two previous books of nonfiction, The Chess Artist and The Devil is a Gentleman. We talked about that book here on this program when it came out. He's also authored a collection of short stories. The title of that is The Hospital for Bad Poets. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number. We have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And we also do have an email opportunity, too. If you want to call in with write in with your questions on email, you can do it that way. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you should certainly feel welcome to participate. I do also want to mention that our guest this morning, J.C. Holman, will be here in our area tomorrow. He'll be doing a reading at the Jane Addams Bookshop in Champaign. This is from 1 to 3, and then he's going on to St. Louis and to Columbia, Missouri. So if you're headed that way, you might look for him. But certainly if you're here and around in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can stop by Jane Addams tomorrow afternoon and meet and hear from our guest. And Mr. Holman, hello.
Hi, David. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. If you didn't include photos of the street signs in the book here, I guess I might have thought it was over the top. You're starting out talking about your childhood and the fact that you lived on Utopia Road, but in fact, you did grow up in a community in California, and you did live on Utopia Road.
Yeah, it was a master planned community in Southern California, as you said, and I think it's an inheritor of some of the really earnest utopian thinking of early in the 20th century. I'm thinking of Ebenezer Howard's Garden City movement and probably James Roos's master plan for Columbia, Maryland. By the time my community was built, I think a lot of that utopian visionary aspect had sort of faded away, and by the time someone was looking down at our little row of starter homes, they thought it would be pretty funny to call it Utopia Road.
Yeah. Note, there's no way of knowing, I suppose, how far back the utopian impulse goes. I think fair to say probably a long way. Certainly there's a long history of utopian literature, people writing about what would be the ideal place. And if you just toss in there the mirror image of the dark side and talk about dystopias, there is an enormous body of fiction. So people in their minds have been going to these places for who knows how long.
Yeah, and I think the utopian literature, dystopian literature, take it all together. Is maybe the best way, the best possible way that we can recognize how literature interacts with real life, because it's a hugely influential body of work. I think that's happening on a kind of micro scale. I mean, it's easy for me to recognize how aspects of who I am and my history and my past are informed by utopian literature. Utopia Road's the name of the place. But that's really true, you know, for everybody, because a lot of the kinds of things that, that people take for granted, whether it's how long children stay in school or women's rights or power-sharing governments or certain kinds of technological innovations, whether it be cell phones or the Internet or solar or wind energy, you know, all of these things can be traced back to utopian literature in one way or another. So we're really all inheritors of a utopian tradition.
Yeah. Well, that gets at what I think is an interesting kind of notion that goes something like to make something, you have to have dreamed it first.
Mm-hmm.
And that that utopian literature does do that. It somehow gives you the opportunity to think about it and design it and do whatever you like with it. But that then, having done that, people have said, well, let's try to actually do this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you know, you said earlier there's a huge dearth of dystopian literature, and I think that pretty much characterizes the 20th century. The 19th century was sodden with utopian literature. And I think, you know, some of the difficulties that we have currently, you know, whether it's, you know, trying to figure out what to do about financial reform or health care or even, you know, sort of the oil spill crisis people currently, because we have this dearth of dystopian literature or apocalyptic movies, we know that things are going badly. We'd like to figure out how to knock it all down and start over, and we keep telling ourselves these cautionary tales. But when it comes to actually moving forward, we're not quite sure what to do. A dystopia is what you write when you want to complain about something, and a utopian story is what you do when you want to propose something. And when you have an absence of utopian literature, as we do now, you're sort of cutting a critical link in the chain for how things come to pass. You imagine it, somebody proposes it, somebody legislates it. But if nobody's imagining how the world can be improved or perfected, it's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I guess, though, you could make the case that, you know, there is an enormous body of fantasy literature out there that exists, and that also goes back some time. And you might make the argument that that's an extension of this, that is a kind of utopia if you define that as being you're inventing what you think is your ideal place, maybe not the perfect place, but whether you think it's the coolest place or the most magical place or the place where you can be the person that you want to be. That there's certainly no shortage of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the 20th century that utopian literature makes this leap into science fiction. But there's even two sides of it there. I mean, on the one side, you have a very earnest utopian like H.G. Wells writing stories that propose, you know, a promising future. But then you have kind of the opposite side of maybe, you know, visions like L. Ron Hubbard or Michael Crichton or Robert Heinlein, who I think, you know, gave us that famous phrase that an armed society is a polite society, which doesn't exactly sound like a particularly progressive, positive future to me.
Thomas More, you write here in the beginning here about Thomas More, who wrote a book called Utopia that maybe was the first example you can point to of clearly something that is utopian literature. What did Moore, in fact, coin that term? Did he make up the word utopia?
Yeah, well, there's a little debate about it, but it's certainly, you know, Moore's book titled Utopia from 1516 that gives birth to the word. There are some who have made the argument that his very good friend Desiderius Erasmus actually coined the word. Nobody really knows. I mean, it's an incredibly inscrutable book. Nobody's quite sure what Moore meant by it, and he eventually distanced himself from it. But what is pretty clear is that in the same way that, you know, whatever real estate developer looked at my little row of starter homes where I was going to grow up and called it Utopia Road as kind of a joke, well, that's what Moore was doing. It was intended as a bit of wit. He didn't mean it to be taken literally or seriously. That's not really what wound up happening. People did take it literally, and they did take it seriously. And it's the incredible influence of that book that accounts for the emergence of an entire genre of literature, literally hundreds or thousands of imitators of Moore's style, but not necessarily his irony. And the influence of that body of literature, I think it's fair to say, makes the last 500 years of human history a history of not getting the joke of Thomas More's utopia.
Well, and here, and this is something that certainly that I did not know, I learned from your book, and maybe people who have Greek would know, but that in that word, literally in Greek, it means something like nowhere, or I don't know if it'd be too free a translation, something like the place that actually doesn't exist. He seemed to be right at the get-go saying that not only is this place real, but I don't know if he was actually then going on to suggest that it such a thing just couldn't be, but he was saying that this is a place that is not.
Yeah, I mean, the whole book is shot through with these Greek and Latin puns that Moore was aiming at his kind of humanist, trained, highly educated audience. So utopia, utopus, means no with a prefix in place, topus. Means no place, and you know others in the book. You know the capital city of Utopia is Amarut, which means city of shadows. And the main character, the main utopian in the book, is a guy named Raphael Hithloday, which translates in a variety of ways, but probably most often as something like nonsense speaker. And so there was lots of keys that people were supposed to recognize that indicated that Moore was actually up to something else other than creating a blueprint. But people didn't recognize those things, and so they wound up taking it literally in one way or another, and then using his methodology to actually make visions begin to come to pass in one way or another.
Well, given that so many people have tried to make the perfect place and failed, or maybe had succeeded for a little while, but not for very long, and I'm sure the cynic would look at that word utopia and say, "Well, Thomas More got it right. Of course, it's not possible. This, you know, these places they don't exist, and maybe they can't exist." Having said all that, why do people keep trying?
Well, I think it may be that you know, even with the sort of earnest utopian visionaries that I'm looking at, that there's a danger to taking even their visions a little bit too literally. I think we get at this a little bit when you think about the word perfect, not as an adjective, but maybe as a verb. You know what do we mean when we say that we want to perfect something? We want to improve it, to make it better. Martin Buber once said that it's been justly said that in a positive sense, every planning intellect is utopian. And so that anybody who's engaged in the process of planning for a better world or attempting to make a better world through human agency and intentionality might be called a utopian. And it's not so foreign to our ears when you recognize that even the first line of the founding documents of the United States tasks us to seek a more perfect union. And you have to have a real tin ear to not hear the utopian echo in that phrase.
Yeah, and I suppose that, you know, maybe when you're talking about this, it is better to perhaps instead of saying something like a perfect place or a perfect world, maybe ideal might be a little bit better. At least what that would acknowledge is that you're saying here, this is what we aspire to, but perhaps at the outset, we're going to admit that this is going to be difficult and maybe impossible. We're going to try anyway, but we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a way of understanding, as Buber says, the sort of planning intellect. I mean, you know, nobody sets out to make a plan and then introduces a couple of flaws to it just because they don't really believe in perfection, and so I'm going to make a flawed plan just so I'm being realistic. You know, you make the best possible plan based on what you know then. You strive for perfection so as to make the best possible plan. And I think it's earnest visionaries, earnest utopians, who have always pushed us imaginatively as far as we can go in terms of what is the best way that people can live collectively. And even as those earnest visions have pretty routinely failed to come to pass, you can trace ways in which those earnest visions do translate to, you know, tangible, measurable, observable change in the real world. And that's what my book is. I'm looking at six different modern utopias in various stages of realization that trace back to recognizable utopian roots.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is J.C. Holman. He is the author of two books, previous books of nonfiction, The Chess Artist and The Devil is a Gentleman, a collection of short stories, The Hospital for Bad Poets, and his new book is titled In Utopia, Six Kinds of Eden and the Search for a Better Paradise. St. Martin's Press is the publisher. Questions, comments, welcome 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And as you just said here, you could write a very big book that's about utopian literature. Well, that's really not what you've done. Your interest is actually to go to some places where some people are trying to do it, where they are trying to make concrete the impulse and make what they consider to be a kind of ideal place. What made you want to actually go out and try to talk to people who were trying to do this?
Well, you know, I mean, as somebody who grew up inside what is arguably a kind of failed utopian vision, I don't think there was anybody better prepared than me to want to sort of hold utopian thoughts accountable for its failures, you know. But, you know, when I started to look at some of the earnest visions that I eventually wrote about, I realized that I didn't just have that kind of knee-jerk reaction, that some of what I was reading about or hearing about it, I wanted to see somebody do it or try it to become active in attempting to make a better world. I think that, you know, imaginatively we're sort of hobbled right now, and it's hard for us to imagine even fixing the crises we have, let alone taking on big progressive projects. You know, it's hard to imagine anywhere in the United States someone taking on something as big as, say, the New York City subway system or the interstate system. You know, it's almost as though we have a knee-jerk reaction to any big plan, and so you know, I wanted to trace back that idea to what is its origin. I think is maybe some of the stigmatization that has been brought to utopian thought and literature, and confound that. You know, I wanted to find those examples of where utopian thought proves itself, at least, you know, maybe not again in terms of having their visions come to pass exactly as they're imagined. But the ways in which earnest utopian visions wind up making or assisting or fomenting whatever change people are actually capable of making.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I gather really started you in on this was when some time ago you came across some writing having to do with something called Pleistocene rewilding. Mm-hmm. Where people were actually talking about trying to take a place, an area, a geographic place, and to somehow get back to the kind of animals, the collection of animals, the ecosystem that would have existed a long time ago. Part of the problem is that the animals that made up that ecosystem are gone, so you can't really do that. But this idea to restore Earth to a prehistoric kind of condition.
Well, not quite prehistoric. I mean, it's 13,000 years ago, the Pleistocene, and so it's, you know, a lot's known about that era. You know, the truth is that North America in particular used to be populated with a large number of large species that are now all gone. And science has shown, the science of conservation biology in particular, has shown that when large mammals are present inside of an ecosystem, you have more biodiversity and more active evolution. Now, if you value those things, a pretty obvious solution is well, what happens if you put more large animals into a system, particularly if you know that those large animals were once there? Can you trigger more biodiversity and trigger more evolution? And they have found that you can. You know, the best example of this is the introduction or the reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone, which helped not only the wolves but also moose and elk and beaver and birds. And, you know, there's a kind of cascade of positive effects that result from that kind of positive action. And so, you know, there's a group of scientists who proposed Pleistocene rewilding, which is to begin to experiment with ways that we could expand that. to become more aggressive in terms of how we attempt to repair bereft ecosystems. Now, even the way you asked the question kind of reveals the problem. You said people are actually suggesting this. You know, that knee-jerk reaction we have to any big brand new plan seems to trigger in us this, you can't do that, actually do that, and yet this is an idea that's scientifically sound, and has a lot of supporters, and all they're really looking to do is to attempt some experiments, but it's almost as though that sort of they sort of bang up against that utopian wall, you know. Mm-hmm. And I realized when I started reading about them, and this was kind of tied into some of my own background, because some of the initial experiments that revealed that this could work were conducted in and around where I grew up in Southern California, so right around Utopia Road. And what I realized, you know, is that I would like to see I would like to see more bison in North Dakota, or I would like to see elephants doing the job of extinct creatures in Arizona, say. Elephants are a great one because they clear brush, reducing the risk of fire. They dig for water that helps other species, and they're endangered in other parts of the world. So it seems like a more aggressive land management style could do a lot of good, but imaginatively, we have some difficulty perceiving it.
Mm-hmm. You, one of the people that has been involved in this, and someone that you talk with and spend some time with, was Dave Foreman, the man who started Earth First, somebody who was well known as a radical environmentalist, I suppose. Some people actually said that he was a terrorist. I don't know if that's fair or not. But tell us about your experiences talking with him.
Well, you know, Foreman, you know, I mean, it's almost characteristic of utopians now, particularly earnest utopians, that they're a little shy of the utopian label, that it becomes such a stigmatized idea that if you propose an idea and someone says that's utopian, it's immediately an insult and an attack. And Foreman kind of fell into that camp, that, you know, he was really active in this movement, but he was also being pretty pragmatic. You know, he is kind of cooled down over the years. I don't think it's really fair to call him a terrorist. He was certainly an activist and a saboteur, but I don't think he didn't want to hurt anybody, you know, and so that label's maybe not fair, but he, you know, was his own utopian plan was also something that comes out of conservation biology. It's maybe something that some of your listeners have heard of. It's this idea of connecting separated, protected spaces in North America by creating cores or corridors between them that animals can use to move from one protected space to another. Now, that in itself is kind of utopian, but Foreman's got a big plan for North America and how we can sort of stitch closed the ecological wounds that we have caused to it by protecting only those places that we thought were beautiful or those animals that we thought were magnificent.
Our guest in this hour of focus is, again, J.C. Holman. We're about midway through our conversation. He is the author of the recent book, In Utopia, Six Kinds of Eden and the Search for a Better Paradise. It is published by St. Martin's Press, which is a kind of an exploration of the utopian impulse. And also, he travels to a number of places where the people were trying to construct ideal worlds, what would be for them ideal world. And the book is out now, and it makes for some good reading. And also, by the way, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, he will be giving a reading at the Jane Addams Bookshop tomorrow from 1 to 3 in the afternoon. He'll also be at Left Bank Books in St. Louis on the 31st and Peace Nook in Columbia on the 2nd in the evening. I think that's a little outside of our listening area, but I'll mention those in any case. But certainly, Jane Addams Bookshop tomorrow, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He'll be talking about his book, In Utopia. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email wilt-talk@illinois.edu. I guess if you think about contemporary efforts at utopian societies, that commune, I guess, is a word that comes to mind pretty quickly. People in since the 60s, at least certainly at one period, there were people who were saying, well, we're going to live in a different way, relate to each other in a different way, and we're going to go off someplace and do that. And we these are our values, and we're going to try to live those values. And I don't know how many of those places actually still exist, but you do go to a place, and I don't know if it exactly qualifies as being a commune, but it is what we would call an intentional community, and one that's been around for quite a while. It's a place called Twin Oaks. It's in Virginia. Tell us about Twin Oaks.
Well, Twin Oaks is probably the most successful secular social experiment in American history, and I think it's probably fair to call it a commune. But commune is another one of those words that has just been so dramatically stigmatized over the years that the world, there's a network of communities like this, have opted for the term intentional community instead, and I think that kind of feeds into the way I'm conceiving of utopian thought, that it's basically identical with positive planning or with trying to make a better world as a result of human agency and intentionality. Twin Oaks was founded in 1967. It's more than 40 years old now, and it was initially an attempt to bring to pass the thinking of B.F. Skinner, the psychologist, who had penned a utopian novel in 1945 called Walden 2. Now, the plan in Walden 2 was to make a better world through a kind of murkily described process called behavioral engineering. And Skinner never really got into the details of what that would be made up of, but they gave it a shot, and for a few years they tried to make that world work, according to Skinner. And then eventually they had to abandon the thinking because it was clear that it wasn't going to work with the people that they had. And the thing about Twin Oaks is that it confounds expectations, because the history of communes or intentional communities is, for the most part, a history of failed attempts. The history of communes goes way, way back, to ancient experiments in Italy, and for America, there are big bubbles of social experimentation in the 1820s, 1840s, 1890s, and for the most part, these are histories of people trying to make better communities that don't work. So much so that part of the stigmatization of utopian thought is based on that these small social experiments don't work. Therefore, utopian thought is invalid. Now, Twin Oaks confounds all that because it works. It is thriving. It's compared to the sort of old stories of New Harmony, Indiana, or Brook Farm, or Twin Oaks is a rousing success. And I liked that about it. I spent 3 weeks there, kind of going through their joining process. I tell the story of those 3 weeks, and I think anybody who comes to utopian thought with a stigmatization based on the idea that kind of small scale communism can't work has to confront the fact that at least in this case it has.
Mm. Well, it seems that in many cases the problem here is that we have some group of individuals that it's their vision. And maybe they recruit other people to it, but and maybe it's something that it says one of our values here is freedom, but that there always seems to be somebody's set of rules that have to prevail, and that maybe people who can live with those rules do well, but not everybody can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's always the case that utopian literature runs the risk of slipping toward tyranny. If any one person winds up being too much in charge, and it's certainly a very, very strong anti-authoritarian spirit that probably accounts for why Twin Oaks has managed to survive, because it resisted that very thing, because they themselves were cognizant of those failures of the past and knew how to countermand it. I would actually suggest that some of this is very similar to the way the United States works. It's not simply that we have a set of founding principles that everyone is supposed to follow based on what some guys a couple of hundred years ago set down as the important things to think about. It's precisely our ability to change and adapt that gives us strength, that lets us incorporate current values that embraces that variety and diversity that is so often one of the reasons that utopias, rigid utopias, let's say, fail.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who's listening this morning in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Okay. Has anybody looked into the 1950s remnant of early socialist commune in Chicago? And I had the good fortune to meet two of the children of the Bishop's Hill Swedish settlement in Illinois. That was in about 1980.
Did you hear the question well enough? The caller sort of broke up a little bit on us right there at the beginning.
Okay. First part of it was, has anybody looked into the Billy Sunday commune in Chicago, which existed up until 1950? And then didn't the Black Panthers have a commune system in Chicago at that time or after that time?
I looked at the history of commune specifically in terms of its American origins in John Humphrey Noyes and Robert Owen and Charles Fourier, the Fourier movement. But utopian thought is one of those crazy subjects that, you know, there are literally hundreds if not thousands of utopian novels, and there are hundreds if not thousands of social experimentation.
I'm just talking about the two that I physically became in contact with.
Right, yeah.
Is there any what is the present state of the Israeli kibbutz?
Well, I don't know about the others. I can't address the kibbutz movement a little bit. The kibbutz movement is in part at least a result of the thinking of Charles Fourier having moved east from France into Eastern Europe and then getting migrating down at least part of that influence into what is now Israel as early as 1910. Israel itself is actually a really fascinating subject when it comes to utopian thought and literature because, again, it confounds that idea that these things can't happen. There's not only the kibbutzim movement, hundreds of what we would now call intentional communities, and Twin Oaks called itself the American kibbutz. There were not only hundreds of those, but Israel itself was influenced by another utopian strain. Theodor Herzl's Altneuland, or Old New Land, was a novel that proposed in very early 20th century, 1905, that proposed the repopulation of the Promised Land with Jews and was so specific with how it suggested that might go about that scholars have since gone back and identified sort of specific infrastructure things, like put a highway here or build a bridge here, that were actually done. So Israel, whether it's the kibbutz movement or Israel itself, is a sort of living demonstration of how utopian literature doesn't always fail, isn't always synonymous with naivete and impossibility, but does actually translate maybe imperfectly or maybe incompletely into realities.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly you can find examples where it has worked. More often, though, it seems that it doesn't, or it's not sustainable, maybe for some variety of reasons. And that's still, it takes me at least back to the question of what is the difference? Why occasionally are there notable examples where it has worked, but mostly what we have are examples where it has not?
Well, I think Paul Tillich once said, theologian and philosopher once said, you really can't understand history without understanding the history of utopia. And, I think that some of our preconceptions, some of the stigmatization has caused us to kind of get the order of things sort of upside down, that normally we would say, someone proposes a utopian plan and it fails, and therefore utopias are bad. It becomes dystopia. Lewis Mumford, in writing The City and History, suggested sort of the opposite. He said that the city was basically in its current form as of about 2000 BC, and by about 400 BC, We had rampant overcrowding and disease in Athens, say. So Plato and Aristotle, in writing the initial documents that we now recognize as sort of the foundational utopian documents, retroactively named, were really reacting to what was already a dystopia, right? That dystopia was simply unplanned civilization. And what utopias are an attempt to do is to repair plans that have gone wrong. But, of course, the utopias themselves may turn out to be plans that go wrong. And the question is, well, what do you do when hope fails? What do you do when a plan fails? Do you stop hoping? Do you stop planning? And I don't think you should. I think that if a plan fails, it's a call for a better plan, a better intentionality. And that's always been the role that utopian literature has played, to take us to the next step, even if that's to replace a plan that failed that came before it.
Hmm. I suppose that a lot of utopias have some kind of spiritual basis, where there is a spiritual impulse that's an important part of what motivates people. In your book, also, you look at some that are not, they're not so much driven, I think, by spirituality or the idea of spiritual perfection as it is to have to capture the good life, not in a spiritual way, but in a clearly material way.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I wanted to get at in the book was just the broad-ranging aspects of utopian thought, that you can come at the subject from lots of different ideas. I was less interested in drawing a kind of left-right polarity when it comes to utopian thought, Democrats, liberals versus conservatives, Democrats versus Republicans, than I was in recognizing that a more important line in utopian thought is the difference between ironic utopias and earnest utopias. And the truth is you can have earnest visionaries on both sides of the political spectrum. So immediately after the portrait I draw of a working communism, I offer up a kind of model of a kind of capitalist utopia that turns out to be this sort of floating this history of floating paradises that moves through philosophers and science fiction writers and engineers and architects and eventually culminates in the building of a residential cruise ship called The World that is floating today. It's out there today. A lot of people have seen this featured on the Discovery Channel and so forth. But it bears an uncanny similarity to the vision of the phalanstery, the Charles Fourier vision of a kind of a perfect hotel where people would live in harmony together. The world is sort of a floating version of what seems to me to be a kind of bourgeois vision of perfection that was clearly articulated, you know, almost 200 years ago.
Yeah, and you visited this ship and talked with some of the people there. Something about it, though, seems kind of sad. I'm not exactly sure how to put my finger on it, but it's maybe it's just that it doesn't sound like the ideal place to me.
Well, I think it's one of those things that confounds expectations. You know if you look at this world, and I may be able to give a little history. When the world launched in 2002, its parent company almost immediately went bankrupt, operating in a post 9/11 travel industry. And the solution was that the people who had bought these very expensive residences on board turned around and bought the company. So now the ship is sort of a floating co-op. And then they essentially had to form a government to figure out where they were going to go and what they were going to do. That's pretty utopian in and of itself. And as well, this ship is one of the more ecologically friendly vessels in the world. So it has a few different utopian dimensions. I think it's if you compare it to what we think of as cruise ships, then yeah, it seems lonely and it seems quiet. But the people on board make the argument that they're not on vacation. You know, this is a home. It's not like it's supposed to be an endless party. So if it's quiet, it's the same, you know, they like that. And they like that for the same reason that people like to live in quiet neighborhoods.
Our guest in this hour of focus is J.C. Holman. Again, we're talking about his recent book, In Utopia, Six Kinds of Eden and the Search for a Better Paradise. He's the author of two previous books of nonfiction, The Chess Artist and The Devil is a Gentleman. And we talked about that book here on this program when it came out. He's also authored a collection of short stories, The Hospital for Bad Poets. And the new book out now, In Utopia, is published by St. Martin's Press. And I do want to mention again that he's going to be in Champaign for a reading tomorrow. He'll be at the Jane Addams Bookshop at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you're interested, stop by. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Belgium, that is the community, not the country, here at line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Yeah, there was a book I got 30 years ago about the Paris Commune in 1871. What about that?
I don't know that one. You know, again, it's a huge history. You know, the commune, the history of communes is one that we tend to equate on a one-to-one basis with utopian thought. Utopia equals communistic utopia.
Okay.
The truth is that the subject is a lot bigger. You have communistic utopias, you have psychological utopias, you have architectural utopias. And my book's a survey. You know, I'm looking at a whole range of kinds of utopias, and because I'm doing it in the way that I am, sort of combining travelogue to specific utopian visions with a kind of analytical and historical take on the thinking behind them.
Okay.
I had to shoot for a kind of representative sampling.
Okay. This apparently happened during the Franco-Prussian War, where I believe the workers in Paris became what was known then as communalists.
Mm-hmm.
And they made Paris a big commune.
And I think
why it was shut down. I forget what happened. But.
Well, something you see is a lot is that utopian visions often find purchase in response to calamity or crisis. Precisely when people begin to think that things have gone wrong, that they begin to engage big solutions. And, you know, I think, again, that sort of speaks, you know, to the modern predicament that we're in, where, you know, whether it's ecological or financial or social, that we recognize that we have a variety of crises to confront, but the stigmatization of utopian thought has left us unprepared to propose or to even imagine how those crises might be addressed.
Yeah. I just thought I'd call and bring that up.
Yeah. Well, and I think I appreciate the comment of the caller, and I'm not an expert on French history. I'm sure there's someone out there listening who is. I think that the thing about this particular point in French history that the caller is talking about, it's when you use the word commune, I guess one shouldn't be thinking about hippie communes, but maybe as something that was it was organized around a particular kind of political philosophy. So I suppose in that sense, it was utopian in the sense that people thought, well, if everybody believed that the way that we did and society was organized the way that we thought that it should be, obviously the world would be a much better place.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that this fits in too, you know, sort of the history of commune cities in Italy. And it's, like I said, it's a huge, broad-ranging subject. And, you know, and because I was wanting to confound some of the expectations, I really wanted to branch out away from a strict history of communes.
All right. To another caller here, Champagne. This is line 1. Hello.
Well, thank you for taking the call. Years ago, there was a book called The New Utopians by Robert Bogoslaw. And he used system analysis to come up with a typology of utopias. And it seemed to me that at least two of his types would counter the one of the impressions you left earlier, that many of the utopians were utopias were just failures when they tried to be practical. If you use one of Bogoslaw's system analysis types, the United States itself and the Constitution might be considered to be utopian. Would you comment on that, please?
Well, I did a little bit earlier, you know, by just simply noting that that you know the task to forever seek a more perfect union is a kind of utopian dimension to the founding documents of the United States. You know, scholars have noted that a number of the founding fathers were familiar with James Harrington's Oceana in particular, and there are some interesting parallels between some of the language in the Declaration of Independence and some of the language of the Levelers, an English organization from the 17th century that was pretty utopian in nature. But in the 20th century, you know, a much more dystopian era, I think it's really fascinating that just a huge range of thinkers, including the author you mentioned, have taken a somewhat benign look at utopian literature and thought. I mentioned Paul Tillich earlier, but Martin Buber too, Lewis Mumford, who I already mentioned, but Charlotte Perkins Gilman is another one, Buckminster Fuller is another, E.M. Chiorin, the philosopher, is another. I use quotes from these people sort of throughout the book, but I thought that together they just made a pretty impressive a pattern of thinkers from all different fields who were all coming back to this idea in one way or another.
Just, we have about 3-4 minutes left. I want to introduce a notion of another kind of utopia that you also talk about here, just again, because I think probably in a lot of people's minds, when you hear the word utopia, what you think of is something that is agrarian. But there certainly are people who are engaging in trying to make the ideal place that's not agrarian. It's very urban and very high tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and this is another utopia that I think confounds some of our expectations, and also confounds a bifurcation in society that I think we've gotten very comfortable with, a kind of left-right, Democrat-Republican bifurcation. We're talking about a city that's going up off of the coast of Incheon, South Korea. The Koreans dredged up a bunch of land off of the coast of Korea and wanted to build a master-planned urban space there. So, you know, I grew up in a master-planned community, but it's just a small suburb, really, as is the case with most master-planned communities. They're relatively small. Now, this is not like Dubai. It's not like some Nabokovian fever dream where everybody just wants the biggest or the, you know, the best or the most outrageous thing they can find. This is an attempt to build a truly functional, multi-use city that is that has a great deal of architectural variety and can serve as a functional city where people actually live. As they've been building this place, which is called New Songdo, what they've been finding is that people want to live there. They want better places to live, particularly in Korea. You know, where, you know, sort of there's a kind of architectural paucity because they built so fast in the wake of the war. But businesses were a little bit more hesitant to buy in, and I think that this speaks to a kind of burgeoning utopian sentiment in the world in terms of green value and a kind of ecological ethic, that what businesses wanted was that kind of ecological friendliness built into how the city was going to be constructed. And so New Songdo has become a kind of laboratory for urban sustainability. They want to be the first city that receives LEED certification, the U.S. Green Building Council standard for ecological friendly construction and development. They want to be the first city that is entirely LEED certified, and as well, you know, become that sort of laboratory for how urban sustainability can be produced in the future. And I think it's an interesting confounding of expectations. You see people from the left and the right, Richard Holbrook and I'm forgetting her name, Christine Todd Whitman, saying positive things about New Songdo, and it whether they live up to the ideals that they're proposing in this place, who knows? But they're about coming up on the halfway point of the construction, I think, and so they're actually doing it. It's not just a plan. And if they do manage to live up to those ideals, it could be another demonstration of how utopian thought translates into reality.
And just very quickly, in about a minute, to round us out, we talked in the beginning of your growing up on Utopia Road, and in the end, as a kind of an epilogue, you go back to your house where you grew up as a kid.
Yeah, and Utopia Road, because it was really sort of a kind of a joke in from the beginning, was not in particularly good shape when I went back there. And I think, I wanted to end on that note because, any sort of sympathetic survey of utopian literature is sort of a utopian endeavor in and of itself. You can't look at where we are now and talk about utopian literature without noting that the world is in, or at least our culture, is in a kind of a dystopian mood. And so that was why I left it on that note. Utopian visionaries are really martyrs to a better world. They don't live to see it. They often have tragic stories. But they're often an inspiration.
Yeah, well, I'm sure your bottom line here seems to be something like, if we couldn't dream of a better world and maybe be foolish enough to try to make one, that the world we live in would be a pretty grim place.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave. It was great talking with you.
Our guest, J.C. Holman, the book In Utopia, Six Kinds of Eden and the Search for a Better Paradise, published by St. Martin's Press. Our guest, J.C. Holman, will be giving a reading at the Jane Addams Bookshop in Champaign tomorrow, beginning at 1 in the afternoon.
Todd Whitman saying positive things about New Songdo. Whether they live up to the ideals that they're proposing in this place, who knows? But they're about coming up on the halfway point of the construction, I think. So they're actually doing it. It's not just a plan. And if they do manage to live up to those ideals, it could be another demonstration of how utopian thought translates into reality.
And just very quickly, in about a minute, to round us out, we talked in the beginning of your growing up on Utopia Road, and in the end, as a kind of an epilogue, you go back to your house where you grew up as a kid.
Yeah, and Utopia Road, because it was really sort of a kind of a joke in from the beginning, was not in particularly good shape when I went back there. And I think, I wanted to end on that note because, any sort of sympathetic survey of utopian literature is sort of a utopian endeavor in and of itself. You can't look at where we are now and talk about utopian literature without noting that the world is in, or at least our culture, is in a kind of a dystopian mood. And so that was why I left it on that note. Utopian visionaries are really martyrs to a better world. They don't live to see it. They often have tragic stories. But they're often an inspiration.
Yeah, well, I'm sure your bottom line here seems to be something like, if we couldn't dream of a better world and maybe be foolish enough to try to make one, that the world we live in would be a pretty grim place.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave. It was great talking with you.
Our guest, J.C. Holman, the book In Utopia, Six Kinds of Eden and the Search for a Better Paradise, published by St. Martin's Press. Our guest, J.C. Holman, will be giving a reading at the Jane Addams Bookshop in Champaign tomorrow, beginning at 1 in the afternoon.